Well, that's not a picture of anywhere in the U.S. That's a picture of where I was doing research in Iceland when I was at Ohio State University. But it was just a nice picture to put something on there. So what I've asked all of the panelists to do is to talk for just two or three or four minutes about where they see things going here. And really the question I've asked is, where do we go from here? What are your thoughts on solutions and changes in management? And so I want to give them a chance to talk, now that they've talked about all the problems, to talk about what some of the solutions might be. And so if you give them a chance to do that, what I'll do after that is I'll open it up for some, what I call a conversation, is what I'd like to have. So I'll be walking around with both microphones so that I can pass them off actually fairly quickly. So with that, you guys can decide amongst yourselves who starts.
You answer all the questions and I'll have to say
anything. There isn't any one thing or any even a few things. There's a lot of different potential.
How about that?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Okay, there's not really one solution on this to the drought or the responses to the drought, but what I've come up with is a couple of potentials that definitely just make sense. So there's always the lower hanging fruit, and one is real obvious, and it's probably been referred to today. In a Mediterranean climate, or in any climate, you have good years and you have bad years. When you have good years, as we had 4 years ago in this state, you have to be a good steward of that water. This isn't that difficult, but it needs to not be handled as a disposable commodity and dumped back through the delta into the ocean, and by the way, cause some environmental damages on its way to that source. So one of the things I think that needs to happen is a lot more recharge. That one farm was Don Cameron's farm. I saw those grapes. I saw that water in there. That was a wet year. They were able to take the water from the Fresno slough. He had drip irrigation there, but he put that on there, and that water went into the soil, and it pre-irrigated and irrigated that particular crop. Of course, you have to be careful of drainage and those kind of things. But there's a whole lot of related to that, and of course California did vote yesterday for potential for two new dams, and that makes a difference as well. So it's how it's managed as well. That's one thing, and the second is a very a little more complex, but I know Jeff Mitchell's very familiar with this one because a good friend of ours, John Diener, has been a proponent of this for a long time, and that is, we have large areas of poor drainage that were there naturally, and they were in the fan skirt position, so they're 15 to 20 miles long. They have less than 0.1% slope, and a lot of those had a water table within 4 feet of the surface sometimes. And, of course, you can't get rid of the salinity because you don't have drainage. There's other issues related to that, such as selenium issues and along with that salt, but we won't get into that right now. But the point is, that water with a good desal plant and good reverse osmosis could be cleaned and reused, and there's a lot of it under there. Plus, the valley seems to be becoming a place to farm the sun too, because solar farms are springing up all over the place. So you could have the electricity there to do that as well. So that's the two things that I see. Those are two potential points that could be done, that should be done, at least for sure the first, and the second should be looked at thoroughly.
So that, me.
Yeah. Well, that worked good.
Let's see. Am I on? I slid the button.
Am I on?
Okay, I just have to get a lot closer.
You're down at the bottom.
Okay. The California Water Plan Update 2013 had those 30 resource management strategies, they were developed and fleshed out a lot through the collaborative process. And they will help us make it through the next planning cycle in 5 years. No, it's planned for, you know, long-term and some short-term conditions. Number one, reducing water demand. Now, we look at agriculture water use efficiency. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to use less water, but we might use what we have more efficiently, grow more crops, produce more, things like that. That'll reduce the demand because our population is increasing, which is going to require more resources. So by making our agriculture water use more efficient, we kind of can cover some of the fact that we're going to be needing a lot more agriculture. We are, you know, that slide that Jeff put up with the crop production, those highlighted ones, you know, for the most part, California is producing 90% or more of the U.S. production in those, not just number one, but 90%. We can also improve operational efficiencies and transfers. We have infrastructure that can't necessarily be managed to do good irrigation scheduling. Some of our canal systems, if we can automate them so that when someone needs the water, they can get the water instead of hoping that if they ask for it the day before, they might get it that day and then they can't turn it off for a day or two. That will help things by improving our infrastructure, conveyance, etc. Increased water supply. Now, we put conjunctive groundwater use under that, but really it goes with that whole storage situation. Groundwater has historically been used during drought situations when we don't have surface water, but when we suck it all up, we need to put it back. And if we can use that to store our surplus water during the high water years, then that's good, we've got it. At the same time, we can have our reservoirs, we can increase the infrastructure there, build more surface water storage too, so that we can capture that. We can go to alternative water supplies like desalination, which may work in some places. It might be too expensive in some places, it might work in some places. We need infrastructure for that, energy for that, money for that, and a place to put the waste product. We can do recycled water in many places. We have, like desalination, we have some permitting regulations that we need to overcome and we also have infrastructure. The water that's recycled isn't necessarily where it's needed, so we have to overcome those barriers. But we're working on those things, and we're exploring some of that. We also have, what was the other thing, stormwater. Stormwater is another one. Again, though, stormwater only works in you have storms and runoff. So if you don't have any of those, then you might use your conjunctive groundwater use and put it in the groundwater so that you can use it the year when it's dry. Okay. Flood management, we always deal with that. Because when it's dry and you have no water in the soil and the rain hits it, it's hydrophobic and it goes with all the sediment. Goes away right down the streams. So we need to think of those too. Improved water quality, and like mentioned before, practice good stewardship. Agricultural stewardship so that when the years are good, we store it, we keep it, we protect it for the future. So we've laid out some of these strategies. Needless to say, we have a lot of barriers to overcome. Politics, laws and regulations, money, money, money.
Well, I'll probably repeat some of the ideas. I'll probably repeat some of the ideas that have been put forth. I think, you know, because agriculture uses so much of the water in the state, they definitely have to come up with more solutions, and they've done a lot, but it is economics. But at an individual level, growers can do things for their ranches, and they really have to look at where they are in their watershed and what type of practices and tools they can use to improve their water situation. And that can be from better, you know, irrigation scheduling and using other types of irrigation systems and training their irrigators. But it also could be, you know, as Jeff, I think, showed, this idea of taking stormwater and percolating it in, and where we have crops that wouldn't suffer during flooding, that's a way to use those that land for recharging their groundwater. So there's definitely, you know, lots of individual things that could be done. But then there's on the higher level, working as a community in the watershed to come up with innovative solutions, and certainly, you know, using recycled water more. There's sewage water all over the state that could be used by agriculture as a replacement for pumping. But you have to plan in advance. It takes a lot of money to do it, but as it's a sort of untapped source of water. And if we can grow lettuce and strawberries on it, I'm sure we can grow cotton. So these are all options we can start looking at.
So. Well, I won't take too much time here, just a couple of thoughts. I think there are a number of folks, as Efren and I have talked about, there are going to be changes in cropping systems that are going to happen. It decisions that people make that are those big picture kinds of changes there. There are going to be continued improvements, as Michael and I have tried to explore there and explain, in water use efficiency and the management that's going to go into those improved kinds of systems. So that's going to keep evolving there. I think what Kerry mentioned too, some of the work we had invited, Don had given us permission, John Diener, who was the farmer that was mentioned here, for 30 years, he's a Westside San Joaquin Valley farmer who has really been laboring with developing these on-farm drainage water management systems there, where the idea there, it's extremely relevant now. He started this way back in the 1980s, where you, in certain parts of the valley, there are these perched water tables or shallow water tables that actually, when farmers irrigate, not all the water goes up through ET. Some of it leaches down through the water and it gets trapped into subsurface water tables there. Well, that water tends to be, over time, somewhat saline. Right? And it is a source of reusable water that could be used. And what John has developed with lots and lots of partners is an on-farm demonstration evaluation that has been shown to be successful, where he will introduce progressively more salt-tolerant crops, halophyte crops, into a rotation. Then he applies that water and eventually uses that water for off-farm use there. So it's become a model system there that may have some relevance in some of these places that is not very widely used. And eventually it's going to be used on some of these purification techniques that are coming in at the tail end of that. So there are lots of different kinds of things that I think are going to become more and more available and used here.
Okay, with that, if there's questions or comments, let's get started. This might be a question for Sabina. I'm wondering, studies have shown that 60 to 80% of rainfall sometimes comes from forests and vegetation. So I'm wondering if there's been any regulations on decreasing deforestation and clear cutting, because I was looking at Google Maps for my GIS project, and I noticed that 30 to 50% of Washington, Oregon, and Northern California are clear cut. And so I'm wondering if that would be a source of increasing water over the Sierras.
That's a good question, and honestly, I can't necessarily really answer that. The regulations that allow or do not allow for forestry practices and certain types of them tend to be a completely different arena than I work in. As I understand it, they the big forestry people need to do management plans, so theoretically they are taking into consideration some of these effects. But indeed, you know, clear cutting can increase the runoff and reduce the soil storage capacity up there. Whether growing all those trees back again would restore things sufficiently and allow for collection of more precipitation, I'm not certain about. We do end up with the fire hazard that we have in the summertime regardless, and so there's a balance. But someone who's a forester might be better answering this question than me.
Don?
Hi, thanks for your presentation. Really interesting. A question for anyone on the panel. I'm not from here. So what I don't have a sense of is the growers, the number of growers, the size of the farms. Do you have small, medium, and large farms? Are they all big? And, you know, to follow on that, they're all going to have to adapt. So are they just making those decisions on their own? Are they working with extensionists? Sounds like there's a lot of people from research institutions and extension involved working with them, but can you comment on any of that?
Go ahead.
Well, I'll tell you, my impression is we have a huge range of farm size. Although a majority of the production is from large growers, when you look at farm numbers, small growers represent actually a majority of the number of farmers. So we have a large range. And on the Central Coast, you can be a middle class income, you know, growing 20 acres of strawberries if you're doing well. So because of the high value of these crops, the farms don't necessarily have to be so large. And as far as, you know, working, where are they getting their information? We have a huge network of people. Years ago, you know, when Extension first started, it was the Extension person that brought a lot of the information. And now I would say there's a lot of private consultants. There's representatives from fertilizer companies and CCAs, the crop consultants, that all work with Extension. And there's a lot of other agencies, the Resource Conservation Districts, the NRCS. So we have many types of ways they can get their information. Do we do that always successfully? Not necessarily, you know. But we're always trying to do better, I would say.
I would just echo, I think I agree with everything from my own region there in the Central Valley there. Lots of people are trying to address these kinds of needs there, but there is a huge challenge, I think. That's why I put up the idea of the Nebraska farm network there. I think that, for us anyway, Michael has had great success with the group of people in his region there, and it's they're very well connected and very informed, I think, but there are huge needs to get it to all the thousands of the farms with varying sizes there. Yeah, so lots to do there. You want to, Carrie?
I just wanted to add that last year when we foresaw the impending dry winter or the potential for it, we got together with these guys at the Center for Watershed
Sciences,
the UCANR division. And we sponsored some workshops to go out to the different commodity groups and the different places to help people, you know, with some management strategies for low water. And we also they also then put together a number of little videos that you can get to there on their site online, so they can, you know, people that couldn't make it to workshops, and you can cover more area that way. So they put together a number of short presentations, and then we're also sponsoring them to update some. We had these drought tips that we published in the 1990s, and they're working on updating those and filling in some of the data caps, which will be available to, you know, people out there actually dealing with this.
I have a comment for the person who was asking about the clear cutting. The region of the state where clear cutting is practiced is primarily in the northwestern part of the state, where the streams empty directly into the Pacific and are not captured for use. So that's really a non-starter. A question. I've got a whole list, but I won't ask one at this point. Given their myriad complexity of water law in the state that are really institutional constraints to good water management, what can we do to change culture in the state?
I think I get to start that one off. Well, you know, honestly, that groundwater legislation we just came up with that passed, three bills requiring groundwater sustainability from the high and the moderately over, you know, most serious groundwater basins, they have to be sustainable by 2060. What that means in actuality, what will really happen, we'll find out. But it started. So something like the drought is really good for getting some of these changes going. We, you know, are also exploring. This drought has also helped us, you know, being able to convince some other people, like our legislature and public, to seriously look at things like desal and what our permitting processes are, what those barriers are to actually using things like that in the field, even on an emergency basis. So that hopefully we can do, we do have some mechanisms that slowly we have been able to get through that in emergency situations, sometimes you can relax some of the requirements or expedite the permitting process. But it's still a long process, and that's why we have the California Water Plan to hopefully start getting the ball moving so when we need it, it's rolling. But you are absolutely correct. It is a constant struggle.
I just want to ask, any entry points for desalinization, like using ocean water? I mean, I lived in Israel for a long time, and most of the urban water comes from the ocean. I'm just wondering if that's even on the table here.
Yes, it's on the table.
Am I on?
Yep.
Yes, it's on the table. And in fact, recently we went through the, I don't know what it's called, but it's a Prop 50 grants for desalinization projects. And some of them are pilot, some of them are demo, some of them are actually doing some stuff we've done. And again, we have actually some of our scientists exploring the permitting to make it more reasonably feasible from that side of things. It is an expensive thing and it works. It might work in some places, but we do have a number of concerns. You know, how you pull it out of the ocean and how you put it back in can have a huge effect on the species and the ecology of that area that we have to be careful about. So we have looked at, we've tried to get some research going and some demos. And in some areas, passing it off onto Mike.
Yeah, personally, on the Central Coast, where I live, we are now exploring that with some demonstration projects, not for ag, but for urban use. And the idea is, there. You know, I showed you that slide where the groundwater goes up and down during the season. And when we're in this drought situation and the groundwater is getting a little too low, then we switch to desalinized water for this period to reduce that pumping, and so we don't pull the seawater into the aquifer. I mean, that's where they're sort of seeing this as a, having a fit, because it is an expensive water, and so probably the first round of this is we wouldn't actually use desalinization all the time, but for emergency situations.
Isn't there a plan on Catalina Island?
You have to talk into the mic, folks, and I have a question from online, so I'm going to...
I was just going to bring up, too, there are mobile desalinization units that we are exploring feasibility of, too.
Okay, this is from somebody online. To the panel, do you foresee a normal year amount of precipitation this winter? What should growers or consultants prepare for?
Wait, let's see, I have a DWR talking point somewhere. You know, that drought outlook was the forecast from the CDC. And it showed basically persisting drought. One of the estimates is that we will need 1.5 times average precipitation to basically recover. And that's not extra, that's just recover. So, like one of these other folks said, prepare for it to be dry.
I'll add, you know, on the Central Coast and Salinas Valley, you know, our reservoirs are pretty empty. There's not going to be much recharge going back into the aquifer. It normally would be recovering at this time of year. And even if we get a normal rainfall, okay, then that water will go up into the reservoirs, you know, by March. They'll start pumping already. So before they can even, if we got a normal rainfall year, our groundwater levels may really drop before we start even recharging there. And that's just if we got a normal year. And if they have very little water going back into those reservoirs, I would expect the groundwater levels, which dropped about 10 feet in where I was showing on the east side last year, would maybe accelerate.
Friday, that picture that Jeff showed you of that storm coming through with the big dust front first, and just about an inch of rain fell on our small town at Hanford. And, you know, it was almost spiritual when I went outside and it was actually raining, because each of the last 2 years we've had about 2.6 inches for the whole entire water year, and then about, I think it was about 2.8. And here we got 1 inch. We had 1 inch over a period of 6 or 7 hours that night. And so, you know, but that's not very much, not in the total scheme of things. You need a number of storms, and they need to be cold enough to get some snow up in this Sierra so that we actually have something in those reservoirs. And so if I were predicting it, which nobody seems to be really good at, although, you know, some may be better than others, obviously, but I would say, yeah, prepare for a dry year, and I think that makes sense. One other point I didn't mention earlier, too, if you do desalination plants, then you do have products afterwards, and they're not bad products. They're products that we're mining other places. Those need to be they need to be turned into products and sold and put onto our highway systems and moved from there. So why should you mine gypsum somewhere when you've got it right there in your soil being solubilized into your water table? There's no reason you couldn't get that gypsum out of there. There's no reason you couldn't get sodium sulfate and all the other things that are in there. Even the selenium. You know, it's bad for wildlife when it's too high, but selenium is still an essential micronutrient for people and for animals. So.
If my memory is correct, I think there is an operational desalinization plant on Santa Catalina Island, and the person behind me told me that there is one in Carlsbad in Southern California. So I think there's stuff like that online.
Yeah. I'll add that the one in Carlsbad is coming online next year in 2015, and I believe the figure is that it's going to be supplying 7 to 10% of San Diego County's anticipated water needs. So it's the largest desal plant on the West Coast. I just happen to know about it because I live near Carlsbad.
Oh yeah, there are a couple of them, but let's keep in mind that the urban use is about 20% of our developed water. So 7% of San Diego, which is not even, you know, we still end up, it can serve really important needs, especially, I think, you know, it's probably more feasible in the urban situation because water's more expensive there, and, you know, you've got a higher concentration of people that you can serve with one plant, so it might be more efficient. It's still not a bad thing to explore just in general in a wider use.
Yeah, just to reiterate, the woman was asking about urban use in Israel, and this is definitely for urban use in San Diego. I mean, it's not dedicated to agriculture by any means, and obviously desal is only a potential for the coastal areas and not for the Central Valley and so forth.
Well, there is a possibility, you know, because some of our groundwater has gotten quite faulty from the agriculture. So we do have some groundwater cleanup that might be feasible through desalinization type situations that aren't on the coast. But again, you know, economics as well as technology and feasibility are all going to play a part.
Wait a second. I would respond to that too as well. It's a large area with poor drainage that much of which was already retired because they knew they didn't have enough water. As the crops were moved up the alluvial fans with higher slopes, the lower areas are still sitting there quite salty with a lot of problems. And so people have just migrated away from those, and that had its own cultural ramifications as well. So however, those are just right below the surface, the water, and it's the equivalent of millions of acre feet. It's not a small amount of water, and it's right under your feet. It's not, you know, hundreds of feet down. It starts just a meter or two down. So it is there. It's a potential, and it might even solve some of the other environmental problems that were caused by some of those drainage problems.
Yeah, I was just wondering, has there been any talk about bringing water in from the Missouri River into California? That's been an issue. I lived in Montana. That was always the case. Something of discussion. Just wondering if now we've reached a point where this is a national concern that the federal government would order such a thing.
Okay, let's get this straight to start with. I am not a regulator. I am just a merely state employee. I haven't heard anything about that, me personally. Whether the people up there are talking about things, I don't know. I don't think it's likely, because I think California can handle its water problems, you know, by investing in California and the people, you know, practicing good stewardship. I don't think we need to do something like transbasin water transfers, which would be beyond the watershed water transfers we have in California. There have been a number of good ideas that have come up and that, you know, are in process, that it would be way more, I think it would probably be more expensive to truck that water in than it would be for us to develop our desal plants. I don't know, not an economist, but that would be my guess.
Earlier this year, a number of farmers had zero allocation from their only source. They made chips out of some very valuable citrus trees. Given that we're probably going to have more zero allocation, what's your prognosis for a much wider incidence of crop abandonment?
Well, you know, in the Salinas area, I'll talk about the Central Coast, we're pumping groundwater, so it's not going to be not allocated to growers. They have the right to pump. And so the problem is that they possibly could damage their aquifer by overpumping and accelerating seawater intrusion. That's the Salinas Basin. In the Pajaro Basin, they can actually put in emergency measures to limit pumping because they're a water purveyor. And then if you go to the Santa Maria area, there's actually they were adjudicated, so they have a water czar that limits and has been limiting how growers pump. And they're actually in pretty good shape because they had someone or a group of people really overseeing the pumping of the aquifer. I'm mostly worried, you know, about the Salinas Valley, but the bright point is that's a big valley, 80, you know, miles long. It has a lot of water capacity, and you know, we could probably make it through another year. But we already have wells going dry, wells collapsing, and that's where, you know, it's going to hit growers. So they, yeah, they can pump, but there's a point where their wells aren't going to produce anymore, and it's going to be they're not going to have the ability to go any deeper. Many of them are at 500, 600 feet, and they've lowered the bowls from during the last drought, and they're already at the bottom. So I think that's where we're going to see maybe some acres in fallow this next season if we don't have enough recharge during this winter period.
I'll respond to that, and I know Nat Della Valle very well. And yesterday he just said the few words, it has to be heard, and I agree. I think the more we talk about this, the more informed people will be. However, and I think that's, and the fact that people were at least somewhat informed, that's why that Proposition 1 passed yesterday. But the other was that David Montgomery quote was, global soil degradation is an underappreciated crisis. I thought, you know, when you've got a crisis, that's when you have to actually come up with solutions to it. And regarding whether we will see trees, in particular permanent crops pulled out, there's no doubt. No matter what happens this year, the folks on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, unless we just get a miracle year, there's going to be a lot of almonds, a lot of permanent crops, and then I haven't seen any pistachios coming out yet, but that's on the west side of that valley. And then on the east side, oranges, there will be a lot of them because they do not have any groundwater. So if we don't get water coming down the Frank Kern Canal from the San Joaquin River watersheds, then they will be out of water, period. And they are that one picture I had there was an orange orchard being pulled out. And so there's a lot of farm work there. You know, it's the ripple effect is fairly significant too, because I'm seeing it in our area as well. So it doesn't look good unless we really, really get into one of the very wet cycles. And I don't see it, but then again, who knows?
I was just going to add that we have shifted to more permanent crops, and that is in general more efficient water use. But it leaves us a little bit more in a danger zone when we have the extremes, because we can't just say, oh, well, I don't have the water, so I won't plant 400 acres, because they're already planted. So that makes it difficult. We are trying to talk with the UCA and our Center for Water, Judd. There's more letters that I'm spacing out, sorry, right now. To come up with and to work together and think about some sort of ways that they can give talks or information to people on, okay, how do I just manage to keep the trees alive? Let's not talk about yield or anything, like, but can I do something that's minimal just to keep them alive? And so we're trying to work with them to see if we can. If we can use their expertise, and they can come up with some reasonable strategies that might be feasible for some people.
I'm just curious. it seems like this is, you know, not this crisis is not specific to California. I mean, it's happening in southern Spain and Italy. I'm just wondering, are there any models for how, you know, this is being managed from other countries or other crises periods about? I kind of brought this up. I mentioned the Dust Bowl about like land use and resource management.
I think Sabrina's optimism there. I think, and it's good to be hopeful. I think, and I think we probably all want to be hopeful. In the course of the meetings, just these last 3 days, there, I've had a chance to talk with some of the people from northern Texas, and just ask them that very question: what's happening there with the depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer in their particular region? And I know some researchers from that area there, and it Are there any folks from other regions here that want to comment there? But it's fairly bleak from my understanding there about what the prospects are of towns and areas drying out there, is at least the impression I got there. So anybody have any? I don't know if that's a lesson for us here, but that sort of debunks the optimism there in some respects. But I think there is hope here.
This is Sabrina Cook speaking, as opposed to a DWR employee. if we get changing climate, everything's going to change all around us over the globe. We're going to get regions that used to be dry that are wetter, and regions that were wet getting dry, and temperatures changing and things happening. However, right now, there are parts of the world that are experiencing those situations. If we could get together a global group to talk about these and to come up with strategies so that when, you know, California goes too dry, okay, what kind of crops can we do? Because over there, they're already like that, and what are they doing? Do we shift production up further north? Does Oregon become the new California? But they have to gear up for that, and they need the resources to know and understand if we were to need to do something like that, you know, what could we do? We may never need that plan or those plans, you know, because we don't know what's really going to happen until it happens. But it would be really nice if we had some global leaders in economics, policy, sciences, talking about this right now, or actually 20 years ago, but I'll take right now.
Anybody else have comments or questions?
One of you guys had talked about cost sharing for, like, say I was a farmer and I wanted to put in drip irrigation or change my irrigation system. I mean, are these grants or are these where you have to put up 50% and the government puts up 50%? Or does this, none of this exist, or is that part of the bond measure that was just passed? Is there any money in there, part of the bond measure, to do stuff like that? Because I would imagine you talked about middle-class farmers. Middle class salary is not very much salary, and to change your system to a drip irrigation system, I would think would be fairly capital intensive. And so, I mean, are there low income loans available? What's available to middle class farmers out there?
How about you equip first?
Yeah.
The agency I worked for previously, before I retired, Natural Resources Conservation Service, they have a program called the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, EQIP. And that one, I know a number of friends that have they have significant coverage of costs for putting in their drip irrigation on their almonds or their other permanent crops. And it's basically you get assistance, and there's money there as well. Doesn't pay for the whole thing. You're going to have to. It's a cost share, but it does make a big difference, especially on a high value crop like almonds, where they're netting $5,000 or $6,000. There's a lot of money, an acre. That's a lot of money people are making now. So, but that's why it really hurts when they rip them out after putting all that time and effort in getting them in.
We have a group that consolidates all the financial assistance, because DWR is just one department. You've got the Department of Food and Ag, and they have their own programs that sometimes do things like that. My own group, we typically provide funding to agencies like the water irrigation districts, and then they would provide programs to their customers. But, you know, if you talk with me afterwards and give me your contact information or whatever, I'll find you that website that is covering all the financial opportunities through the state of California that may or may not be applicable.
Well, the program I mentioned was the State Department of Food and Ag program, and there you have to have a cost share, plus you have to demonstrate in the application certain significant changes and improvements in your before and after systems that you're proposing. So, yeah, and there may be more of that opportunity. I don't know that, but that exists right now, and it's available to anyone, any farmer, yeah.
Anybody else? Any concluding statements from the panel? You kind of set it up, huh? Okay, well, I want to thank everybody for coming today, and hopefully we can continue this conversation on whatever venue we can find. I think Sabrina's is a lofty goal, but I think it's a good thought. But I think these are important conversations to have and important information to pass through. So thank you again for joining us today.